Three messages before we get started. If you're a tech entrepreneur, don't you have unique legal needs that the average lawyer can't help you with? That's why you need Scott Edward Walker of Walker Corporate Law. If you read his articles on VentureBeat, you know that he can help you with issues like raising money or issuing stock options or even deciding whether to form a corporation. Scott Edward Walker is the entrepreneur's lawyer. See him at walkercorporatelaw.com. And do you remember when I interviewed Sarah Sutton Fell about how thousands of people pay for her job site? Look at the biggest point that she made. She said that she has a phone number on every page of her site because, and here's a stat, 95% of the people who call end up buying. Most people, though, don't call her, but seeing a real number increases their confidence in her and they buy. So try this. Go to grasshopper.com and get a phone number that will make your company sound professional. Add it to your site and see what happens. Grasshopper.com. And remember Patrick Buckley, who I interviewed? He came up with an idea for an iPad case. He built a store to sell it, and in a few months, he generated about $1 million in sales. Well, the platform he used is Shopify. If you have an idea to sell anything, set up your store on Shopify.com because Shopify stores are designed to increase sales. Plus, Shopify makes it easy to set up a beautiful store and manage it. Shopify.com. Here's the program. Hey there, Freedom Fighters. I'm Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy, home of the ambitious upstart. And the next time you think that it takes, you know, huge investment, takes building big software, takes doing something that takes years and years and years before you launch, or even months and months and months before you launch, I want you to think of today's interview. Today's guest built a hit business selling templates. Yep, templates. Amir Khela. Right? Did I get that right?
Yes.
I had the "h" right, but I got the rest of it wrong. Amir Khela is the founder of Keynotopia. He makes templates for Apple's presentation program, Keynote, and transforms that program into a beautiful prototyping tool. Amir, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Amir Khela. How many customers do you guys have?
Last time I counted, we had over 30,000 customers.
30,000. And actually, I said we. Is it how many people in the company? Is it just you or more?
Full-time myself, but I have people helping me out with right now with design, with programming, and even with business. Okay. But on a full-time basis.
Just as you need them.
Yeah, exactly.
And how much revenue have you made with this?
Enough. Enough to keep, you know, to have a good lifestyle and pay people who work with me.
More than $500,000?
Between $1, maybe, and $500,000.
Between $1 and $500,000.
Yeah.
I actually know the number you told me via email, but I wouldn't reveal it. You did say, though, that you got training in how to not answer questions that you don't want to answer. And I thought, let me see where I could push him with this. Where'd you get that training?
I worked with Microsoft as a PM for about 3.5 years. And I was working on a confidential product that wasn't launched yet, and we released some previews for the press and for developers, and we get just basic training about how to answer a question without answering the actual question.
All right, but we
still
do
give something valuable. Like, the secret is, like, the reporter asking you something, you should still give them something valuable, even if you cannot answer the question they're asking you.
And in this case, you gave me something valuable. You told me 30,000 customers. We'll find out in a moment what you're selling the. Actually, I'll say it right now. It's what? You've got $49 product, $97 product. The cheapest is $39, right?
Right. And you have free templates as well.
And you have free templates.
Yeah. So 30,000 is including free customers.
Free customers too.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. So that was, I'm glad that I asked then. I thought it was all paying customers. All right, but the revenue is solid. You and I have talked about it privately. I'm not going to force you to reveal anything that you're not comfortable with. I just want to learn from your story and see how you did this. And for you, it all started out with coming here from where? To the U.S.
From Egypt.
From Egypt. What brought you to the U.S.?
In 2001, I was working at a great software company in Egypt, but I was working as a software engineer, but I was mostly interested in user interfaces for as long as I can remember. My kind of Christmas gift feeling was trying out a new program and seeing the user interface and playing with it. So I came to the U.S. with a PhD scholarship at the University of Maryland, and that was in 2001, which wasn't really the best year for someone from Egypt coming to the U.S.
Wow, what was going on in 2001?
Well, we had September.
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
I see.
Wasn't,
so how did it impact you? Were people saying, hey, get out of my country, terrorist?
It wasn't that bad. Fortunately, I was living in a very educated town, like University of Maryland was a great town. I remember just having some challenges with my landlord, but we got over them.
What kind of challenges?
For a PhD student, it's actually very very tough to survive with the stipends that they give you, because it's a scholarship. So most of the money is going toward paying your education at the university, and they give you, it was like $1,000 a month to survive on. And it was a huge step back for me because, I was working a very comfortable job, and I could have taken a job like with Microsoft or a big company and make a good salary. But to me, I had to make this step back to go forward faster, to go forward in the direction that I wanted, because I knew I didn't want to continue being a software engineer. I enjoy programming, but for fun, not for launching products that are, that I write from scratch.
And so I understand spending a lot of time to learn, to educate yourself and be ready for better things, but I'm looking at your business right now. I've got all these beautiful templates up on my screen. Do you really need a PhD to build Kinotopia?
No. No.
So how did it help you to get the PhD?
You don't know. In retrospect, you don't know, right? So the PhD, I was working on a field called HCI, human-computer interaction.
Mm-hmm.
2001, that was a very, relatively obscure field in computer science compared to, computer vision or networking, which is where, everyone around me was going. But I got into this field because the funding that in the graphics lab that I was working at was just ran out, and they told me just find a good professor to work with. And I found a professor called Ben Peterson, and I owe him a lot with what I know and what I do right now, because he's a great guy.
All right, so you're making $1,000 a month living in Maryland, basically scraping by, trying to figure out what you're going to do with the rest of your life, right?
Right, and $1,000 that pays rent, food, books, computers, transportation, everything.
Soon after that, you went to work for Microsoft.
Right, about 3 years later.
How'd you like working at Microsoft?
Very smart people. I love the team I was working with. We had our challenges because we were running like a startup inside a big company. We were like 35 people, including the PMs and the QA and the developers. So it's a great place to be if a long-term career at Microsoft is what you want. It's great benefits, very smart people. It's not really. Remember, I left before recession, so I don't know how things changed right now, but just people are amazing.
Incredible security.
You mean job security?
Job security. You feel safer in life, no?
I don't think that it's such a place where you have incredible security.
Okay.
I've never really connected with the job thing. I just did what I love doing. If it happened to be a job, that's fine, but when I left Microsoft, I actually had people tell me that, I wasn't grateful to have this job. And I was trying to convince myself every day that, my lifestyle has probably put me in the top 1% of the world's population. But you cannot rationalize your way through life. You can only just follow what you think is right for you without having, influences from people, at least in terms of where you decide you want to go. So security, having your next paycheck guaranteed, of course. But you also give up a lot of freedom in terms of when do you want to take your time off, or can you guarantee that no one will pull the plug on you and suddenly you have mortgage and car payments and kids to pay school for and all these things? It's just not, to me, I can, the security that I feel is knowing that tomorrow I can create something else for people.
I see. Something. I was going to ask you, do you have security now with Kinotopia? And the answer is it's not from that. You're saying it's because you know you could create something else, because you have the power to create your future, to create a business that you feel safe.
Right. And, you know, I think it was helpful that I read a couple of, a good book and a good biography before I left Microsoft. And these impacted my decision a lot.
What was the biography?
The biography was Buckminster Fuller's biography. And if you look at my latest blog post, I summarized what I learned from it. And that was a guy who just came to the brink of suicide. He actually went to Lake Michigan to suicide. And then he heard a voice saying, your life is not yours. If you don't want it, turn it around and give it to people. And he believed that, the same system that supports nature and animals and all the ecosystem in the universe applies to humans as well. If you're doing what is the right thing for you to do, I always say that life is selfish. Life will support you in the way that you will get most value out of you for others, because that's how an ecosystem works. So if you keep providing value the way you're meant to provide that value, you're kind of like you're finding your, as a little gear in that whole system, you're finding where you fit and you operate, there's no reason you won't be supported to continue doing that. And I based all my decision based on that belief.
And I think we're going to see some of this come out as we hear your story, starting with this experience that you had that it seems like caused you to leave Microsoft.
Right.
The accident, the near accident.
So what happened? I was driving home. That was in 2006.
Mm-hmm.
I was driving home from Microsoft. And I used to live 10 minutes away from the park. And there was every day around 5:30, it was like a mass exodus from Microsoft, people going home, and the freeways just bumper to bumper. And since I lived in the same city as Microsoft, I just decided to take the exit and take the inroads. Now, I'm stopped at the first car at the red light. I get green light and I need to turn left. And my foot hits the brake. Actually, I noticed the car stops. And then I'm like, what's going on? Why did I stop? And I look at my foot and my foot is on the brake. And I'm confused because I didn't hit the brake consciously. I was just hitting gas. And with the corner of my eye, I see a guy running red light, 40 miles an hour, coming into my driver's side door. And that was the moment where I had this kind of Hollywood experience where it was like a tunnel that was pulled back from my body. Everything was so far away, so quiet and so slow. It's almost like time just has a different relative meaning at that time. And I was basically preparing to leave my body. And then the driver saw me, lost a fraction of a second, and he hit the brakes and he started skidding in the middle of the road. He was so close that the wind turbulence from his car coming so close just shook my car sideways. And he stopped in the middle of the road. And at that point, while he was braking, I was pulled back into my body. And everything, it's almost like you're going through the tunnel again. Everything was just suddenly so loud, so bright, so fast that I had to shield my eyes. And then, as if someone just hit the pause on the remote control, right? All the street is just still. And I do nothing. There was no accident. I'm not going to report anything. I just drive back home. And when I got home, I realized, when I was a kid, I always thought that I would live beyond my 30th birthday. And that day was the eve of my 30th birthday.
You thought you wouldn't survive to your 30th birthday?
Yeah, I just knew it when I was a kid. I knew I would die before the age of 30. That was just a feeling that I had.
You know what? I see as you're telling this, you're checking me out to see if I would
judge you critically for this? Am I going to think that he is a wacko, or am I a fellow believer? Do people think that you're, when you get into stuff like this, how do people react?
It's purely scientific. Well, first I learned that, you know, everyone is judging someone else by their own experience, and everyone's experience is limited. So I don't try to convince other people about something. I just tell them what is true for me, and if it resonates with them. But the truth is, we're here in life as like a, you know, we're here as a glimpse. Everyone's life is a glimpse, and I like to terms of the
glimpse
life of the universe. Yeah, it's like a spark, right? And it would be very, you know, in engineering terms, it would be very useless, waste of energy if we're just here as bodies without anything operating it. And my own experience tells me that I'm not, you know, when I was born and raised as a Christian, and we were always told that you're here, and when you die, your soul will return to God, right? But could it be that we are, you know, we just have these bodies, just a simple shift of perspective. We are souls or spirits or whatever you want to call it, just infinite beings having these vehicles that we call bodies and with minds.
All right, I'll tell you this. I'm not judging this in any way. I was even going to start asking some questions about it, but then I realized this is outside of the scope of the kind of interviews that I do here.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you more questions about it as they come up, but I've got to focus back on the company. Only because I hear the person who's listening to us in their minds going, Andrew, you told me that this guy's building a business on templates. Get to that. So I'm going to get to it. And we'll come back a little bit to this because I could see how important it was in how this outlook on life has impacted your business. Yeah. But the bottom line is you had this near-death experience. That caused you to leave Microsoft.
It wasn't so soon. It took a year for me to kind of gather my courage, do enough contemplation, and realize, you know, it's a great company, but it's not for me. I'm not happy where I am. And I don't know, maybe that experience made me a little crazy, a little reckless, but seeing, it's almost like you've been playing a game from believing that you're avatar in the game, and I just realized I'm a player, I'm controlling this avatar that I call body, and I can take it wherever I want.
Did you have something lined up for after Microsoft? Did you just leave it? No.
One day I just woke up and I realized too many days in a row I woke up and I didn't want to go to work. And it wasn't because I needed a vacation or, I actually switched teams before leaving Microsoft. So I wanted to see if it's me or the team or the product. And it wasn't any of that. It was just me. I can't, you know, it was time for me to take the next step in my life. And like I said in the beginning of the interview, I had people, you know, my friends were calling me, you know, ungrateful because I have this great job, you know, job security. I have good salary and I should just settle down, buy a house, start a family and so on. But I knew I would be miserable if I had done that.
Okay. And years later, you started doing design work and development work for other companies. You even started your own company, which did work for other startups and bigger companies. And once again, you left that part of your life behind. And did you know when you said, hey, you know what, I'm not going to do any more design work for startups, for bigger companies, I'm just going to leave. Did you know what you were going to do next at that point?
No.
Also, just walked right out.
It was even more difficult because it was a business that I created. It was profitable. It was doing great. I was working with great people. I really, really loved working with startups. We helped launch about 12 or 13 products in 3 years, and 3 of them have been acquired. So it was a very successful path, and I could have just taken it much, much further. But again, I realized that I was under control of my business rather than being in control of it. So I woke up every day and I felt that I didn't want to do it. It's a bad feeling.
Give me an example of what made you feel like you were a slave to your business. Most people who don't have companies would think, hey, if I ever had paying customers and a business that I knew what I was doing in, what I knew what I had to do every day, I'd be happy. But you felt like a slave. Give me an example of something that made you feel like a slave.
The last contract I did was with a big, big company. And they're not allowing me to mention them because they want people, you know, to know that they design their own products. But we designed their product, and it was kind of a little bit of a drag because there was so much bureaucracy, and we just had to settle things in a way that made me feel I was making a compromise on some design decisions, and I hate that. And I just need to know that if I'm making the design, I should be making the decision whether or not this design is the right thing. I shouldn't compromise on anything. And I want to kind of step back and I said, if I own my own products, I'll be making all the decisions. Because I know if it's a mistake, I'll learn from it. But I don't know, I'm kind of a little strongly opinionated with the experience in design.
Did you do just design or design and development too?
In the beginning, we did just design. Actually, by the end of the consulting work, I did it for about 3 years. So the first 2 years, did design, and I had a couple of people working with me as contractors, friends that I had met in Seattle. The last year, I was only doing user experience consulting, so I kind of refined my process so that I kind of independent from doing the design work. I think companies should not outsource their design work. They should maybe get some user experience help, but they should be doing the design in-house.
Why?
Because you're building dependency on someone else for something that's becoming very critical for your business, which is understanding what your customers need and knowing how to present it to them in a way they can use it.
All right. By the way, you seem to have a natural gift for design that I don't have. I'm even looking at your screen. You're wearing just a plain white shirt, but it doesn't look like a plain white shirt. There's something about it that looks good. If I wore a white shirt, it would look like
it is a plain white shirt. Believe it or not, there's nothing about
it. It looks good. You've shaved your head down to practically nothing, but it looks good. I tried doing that. I look dorky.
I'll help you out. You're in San Francisco. Let's shave your head.
We should. We'll meet together.
Okay.
No, don't shave my head. I don't think that would look good. But I could really use that. I wish I had that gift. I'm looking at your designs here of the templates. They just look freaking stunning. I feel like that's why a lot of people come to you, because they want that design. They want that gift.
Quality. I was giving a talk at 500 Startups, Dave McClure, venture fund. And that was probably early this year. And someone asked me, that was probably in March, and someone asked me, how did I get John Gruber, Daring Fireball, to mention Kinotopia in his blog and his Twitter? And I had, the only reason I knew John Gruber mentioned me is because the server went down for like probably half a day. I got so much traffic because of that. But I don't actively go and ask people to write about my product. Maybe in the beginning, I have a network of friends that when you're launching something, I tell them, hey, we're launching this. If you want to mention it to your audience, appreciate it. They're going to get a lot of value from it. But I focus a lot on the quality of the product. I'm a quality freak. And to the pixel, like if something needs to be designed perfectly, it has to be designed perfectly.
Give me an example of something that drove you nuts that maybe no one in your audience, none of your customers would have even noticed, but it drove you nuts and you had to get it right.
Like gradients in Keynote, right? Keynote is powerful, but I could easily just grab some screenshots of iOS components and put them in Keynote, and no one will notice, because the way we have them now is like they're pixel perfect. They look exactly like the component. But because I told people that it is the vector components designed from scratch in Keynote, we don't paste any photos, we don't copy from screenshot put it, people will not actually, I think 90% of people using the templates will not notice that, will not notice the difference. If I give them screenshots, like the on-off switch for the iPhone, they're not going to know the difference. But it's just the premise of the product is that everything is vector, everything is reusable, everything is customizable. That I care about so much.
Yeah, I don't think I would notice if you just gave me a screenshot. All right, I'm going to come back to that in a moment. Let's go through what happened next. You decide, hey, you know what? I am done with this. I don't want to be a slave to someone else's design. They don't care about every pixel the way I'm passionate about every pixel. I'm going to just stop. So you stop. You take some time off to figure out what you're going to do next?
More to recover from what I've
been doing. Recover. How do you recover? How do you regain yourself?
I take long hikes. Okay. I meditate. I go to the beach. I read new things. Nothing related to the technical field, but you know, fiction and maybe stuff from Zen and so on. And I know it's been consistent that every time I kind of allow myself to take that space, it's almost like every time you're trying to pull into your field or pull into your mind something that, what am I going to do next? What am I going to do next? But it's just there in front of you, and you need to stop looking for everything around it to see it. And to me, you know, that was March of 2010. I had to take that break. I just couldn't tolerate working on the business anymore, and it was a bad feeling that, you know, it's my own business and I can't keep doing it. That was the consulting business. But again, in retrospect, it's because I've reached the end of the road, and I need to make a turn. And usually, you know, you don't see the next path until you make that turn. It's very hard. You know, some people are lucky enough to have that future just a straight line. They can sit in the beginning, they can see all the way through the end. Or they can decide, you know, all the way through the end. To me, it's always been, I know the next step. I'm going to take that turn. And once I make the turn, I can see the next signpost. And that says, okay, I need to do this thing now. But the turn is slow. Usually when you're driving, you need to slow down around turns, right, in order not to crash into something. So I slowed down. That was in March 2010. April 2010, Apple comes up with their iPad, first iPad. And I go to the Apple store, I'm playing with it, and because I wasn't really trying to get anything out of it, I was just playing. And like, oh, this looks like a cool device. I'll buy one, take it home, and play with it. I took one home. I started playing with it. I had been using Keynote for designing for, you know, the consulting business for a while. I thought, oh, this would be fun to actually try Keynote and export something to the iPad and see how it works. And it worked. It looked like a real app. So I created a very long, comprehensive blog post, step by step, exactly how I do things in Keynote and how it works on the iPad. And I think because the iPad was just out a few weeks earlier, it kind of picked up and became viral, and people shared it, and they shared the video, and that became a business.
So let me see if I understand this. Most people use Keynote to create presentations. They say, PowerPoint's a little bit old. It feels, it's not as beautifully designed as Keynote. I'm going to switch to the Apple product. I'll create better presentations with it, and that's it. You used it to design? What do you mean by that?
Keynote has, you know, 20% of the design features that I can create 80% of my designs with. It doesn't operate on the pixel level. It's a shape. So it's kind of like Illustrator. It's not like Photoshop. So you're creating shapes, but then I can put text inside shapes, meaning I can create labels inside buttons. I looked at it, and I think the first time I used it was friend's laptop. He wanted me to help him out with a web app, and he didn't have any design tool on his Mac. The only thing he had was Keynote. Like, okay, let's see if this works. And I look at it, and I play with it a little bit with him. Like, wow, this actually beats all the expensive tools that I've been using.
Like, what kind of design did he need?
Just a web page. Just, you know, he had a web app, so just needed different screens for his app.
Ah, I see. And you were using it to create a mock-up for him.
Yeah.
To say, hey, the button should go here. You need a little design there. And because he had no other design program on his computer, that's what you use. And that's what made you realize this is a powerful, quick design or mock-up building tool.
Right. It's got the basic shapes. It's got basic colors. It's got, you know, right now, I think it became a movement right now that a lot of designers are just leaving expensive design tools and just moving to Keynote. And I've been I've been talking with a lot of designers, and you know, recently there was a company in Germany, it's a big design agency in Germany, and they actually designed the final product in Keynote because it's just simple, right? Wow. You want something that gets you fast and gets you the right work done. And that, you know, Keynote to me, I use it probably 50% of the time that I'm on the laptop.
All right, so now the iPad comes out and you say, hey, look, you guys don't have to develop programs to see what they look like on the iPad. You can just design them in Keynote and get a sense of what they look like on the iPad and even move those designs into the iPad and see what they would look like on the device itself. And then if you like it, then you can create the product that you've just designed.
Right, and the real trick there was making use of very tiny obscure feature in Keynote called hyperlinks. So you can basically have nonlinear presentation by linking shapes to go to different slides. So now you can actually say, I clicked this button or I tapped this control, take me to the next screen. So when you actually play back and you look at yourself like, wow, this is just, you know, it's an illusion. But, you know, one of the people who contacted me a few months back was Sam Ovens, and he interviewed with you and used set to sell his designs to clients by showing them how it works, and most of them believe that it was actually the final product. And I get that a lot from people who use the product, that their customers don't know if it's the real thing or just a fake prototype.
Yeah, I didn't know that until I saw your product, that I can click, if I create a presentation in Keynote and I add a button to it with a hyperlink, when I click that button, the hyperlink takes me to another page in the presentation. So yeah, it feels like I've done something, some kind of movement within an app. And that's what you were showing people. And now, how does that become a business? How does this discovery that you made, this design that you used based on that discovery and the blog post that you wrote, become a product that you start selling?
Sure. Behind, put the blog post for people to use. I shared my templates freely with people, and I think within 1 week or 2 weeks, I had over 500 downloads. And it was just for the iPad, but people started emailing me like, we need this for the iPhone, we need this for the web.
So you created a Keynote template at that point, and you started handing it out?
So I put everything I know in that blog post with a video demoing the prototype working on the iPad and step-by-step how to do it. And then I'm like, okay, and here are, by the way, templates that I created this weekend, and feel free to use them. There were so many downloads and people asking for more templates for web and iPhone, and they're like, we're willing to pay for them. And until that point, I didn't believe that someone would pay for design templates specifically for Keynote. They're not like professional Photoshop. So it was 1 weekend where I had a friend over, and we were both very inspired by just quickly launching products. And we just decided to sit down one evening and hack the product each individually to see if each of us would be able to launch something.
I see. You each would work on your own product, but you said, let's see what we can launch quickly. We hear and we're inspired by all these people who say that they've launched their products fast. Let's see what you and I can do. You work on your product, I'll work on mine. If we need help, we'll be there for each other, but mostly we'll just be there to hold each other accountable. That's the idea?
Right, yeah, or to inspire each other, to keep each other sitting down instead of going to the beach or something.
Okay.
But, there's something that I forgot to mention, is that in 2009, I'd taken about 9 months off from my consulting business to work on another product that I never launched. And I did everything the opposite of what I did later in Keynotopia. So spend over, but I think between 10 and 15 grand of my own money working on the product. That was during a recession. I had a full-time developer working with me. It took 9 months. It was feature-rich. And needless to say, every feature you add adds bugs. And you had to fix the bugs, and then At some point, I just ran out of the money I allocated to that project, and I said, maybe I'll come back to it later on. after doing more consulting. But in the second time around, when I launched Chemotopia, I wanted to do it the opposite of what I've done before. So the budget was, I think, under $50. That was the entire budget for the launch, a WordPress template, hosting, and domain name, and eJunkie for fulfillment. Launched it in 3 hours, didn't take 9 months. And so I created this, product, basically WordPress template, website, fulfillment system from eJunkie. You don't need to be like an Uber developer to be able to put these things together, just basic knowledge of HTML and some setup of WordPress. And, given my design kind of fanatism, right, it looked very ugly. And I was really ashamed of how the website looked. The templates were good, but the website looked pretty ugly. And I remember just going to the kitchen to fix myself some late night oatmeal. And I was thinking that maybe I should just take it down until I can do something that looks good enough that, is presentable. And I made the decision. I'm like, okay, I'm just going to pull it down. It's like nobody will really care about a few weeks in a delay. And I go back and I find this email from PayPal telling me that I just paid the first sale. That was like within 10 minutes of launching the website. And so I didn't pull it down. I keep improving it. That was the big lesson, is even if something really ugly but delivers the value that people need, it will work. And keep improving it. So, there's this Japanese concept of Kaizen, which is constant improvement to a perfection. And it's better than trying to perfect something before launching it, because you never know which direction you want to take it to perfection.
I understand within a few hours how you can build a WordPress site and launch it, how you can have a shopping system using eJunkie, get that going within a few hours. But how do you create the product, the actual templates that you're selling to people that will enable them to use Keynote to design their iPhone and iPad apps?
Well, to actually test your idea, you don't need the product. So there is a product that we're going to be launching, a new product we're going to be launching in January. And the way I basically tested demand for that product is the exact same thing. A couple of hours of work with WordPress to set up the site. There was even no shopping cart there. I created a bunch of screenshots for the product and a buy now button. But the buy now button will just take you to a sorry page where we say, okay, we're sorry, we're still working on the product, but if you put your email here, we'll let you know as soon as it's ready. And for a few months, I've been testing the demand for the product that way. And if, I realized there is enough demand.
That's what you're doing today. And that's how you know whether you should be building something out. But back then you did the same thing. You said, I know I can develop these templates for people if they pay me for it. I just don't know if there's enough people out there who want to pay. So you said, I'll create a WordPress site with an eJunkie shopping experience. And if enough people pay me for it, then I'll sit and create the templates.
But that wasn't the case before. So
that was or was not?
That was not the case with Chemotopia. With Chemotopia, I knew from the blog post that I wrote that there is enough demand because people downloaded, the templates, the free templates, over 500 times. So I knew that it's useful for people. But
I'm sorry. What I'm trying to understand is, how did you, in that evening that you worked with your friend, not just launch the site and the shopping experience, but actually create the product that you sold?
Because it was easy to create. I had the templates for the iPad before. Creating the ones for the iPhone and the web wasn't that difficult. It took a few hours. They were very basic. They were like a couple dozen components back then. Right now it's over 3,500 components.
So it was a few buttons, a few of...
Very basic, right. And in the beginning, I was selling it for $9.
Okay.
Now it's priced at almost $100 because I kept increasing the value. And most people who, buy it, they tell me, it's underpriced. Just you need to charge more. I'm like, no, that's a good price for most people. But, you know, back to your question, there is something important that I learned also from doing this 3-hour launch. In 2009, I joined an incubator in Silicon Valley, and I had like a 3-page business plan about an Uber design, web design and iPhone. There was no iPad back then, but iPhone design tool that I wanted to create. And literally there was one bullet point in that business plan at the very end of the last page that says, oh, and since I've been using Keynote for prototyping, maybe I make these templates available for subscribers. And sometimes you have a big vision for a big product, but if you realize what is really, really something minimal and valuable that you can launch, it doesn't have to be the full vision, but something valuable, something that solves a small problem, an annoying problem, painful one, that solves it really well. And to me, I always had the dream of launching my own design tool, my own prototyping tool. But these templates solved the problem for, you know, tens of thousands of people because they weren't about to learn a new tool. They weren't about to, you know, do things right.
So you were going to create a whole software program, kind of like Balsamiq, that enabled people to prototype.
Mm-hmm.
I see. And then you realize, hey, you know what? I could do this on Keynote and keep it really simple. Just create templates, sell people images that work with Keynote.
Right. And in retrospect, I didn't know it would gain that much traction. But I knew that enough people are using Keynote and PowerPoint to know how to use these tools. I don't need to teach them something else. I just need to let them know that, hey, you can also use this for prototyping. And right now, when I get like emails from teachers and instructors saying, you know, kids in schools are using the templates because they just have PowerPoint and Keynote installed in the labs. They don't need to learn programming. They don't need to learn anything else. It just works for them. Like, yeah, that, you know, makes sense. I didn't know that when I launched it, but that's good to know.
I see. That's right. Now it works with PowerPoint also, right?
Right.
Right. So if they don't have a Mac, they just have a Windows computer, they can still do this. One of the reasons why you didn't launch this sooner is something that I think would stop a lot of people from launching. The idea that you can't just sell templates. Only charlatans would sell just templates. Real serious engineers, people with PhDs, people with real business backgrounds, they would launch real programs. You had that, right?
Yeah. I think I had the imposter syndrome, where you feel like, oh, can I really charge for templates? Would someone actually buy it? And when I launched them, I realized, oh, maybe because, you know, entrepreneurs and people with, you know, very limited budget and people who don't know how to use design tools or to program the clickable interface would use them. And to my surprise, probably 30% or more of the clients are designers. But I think, you know, I think the smarter and more sophisticated we get, the more we overlook the simple solutions. And maybe that's something that taking that break in 2010 allowed me, which is, you know, stepping from the expert's mind into the beginner's mind and being able to think like someone who wants to create a new app who doesn't have expertise or money. And that beginner's mind lets you see like that Zen saying, you know, beginner's mind, that is all the possibilities. So I wasn't eliminating the possibility of these templates. I was just freaked out that, you know, everyone who buys them will call me back and say, I want my money back, because these are just, you know, templates. They're not really like real components that I can use in the...
I could see having that fear. All these people not just asking me for money back, but saying, you're a fraud. You're someone who I looked up to as a designer, and now you're selling... Yeah. So... Give me more of an understanding of how you got the courage to launch that, because I will need that at some point. Someone in my audience will need it. And frankly, the further along you get, the more promise you have, the more results you have in life, the less likely you are to do what you did, the less likely you are to build that simple product that people really want, and the more likely you are to build something that's much more complex that you think will earn their money. So how'd you get that courage?
just realizing that any fear really begins as a thought in my mind. And by really watching these thoughts carefully, I can discriminate between real fear and made up fear. So I realized just all my fears are made up. Worst case scenario, I'll just refund everyone, put the templates online for free, and that's it. I'm not going to work on them further. The biggest shift was when I launched them and realized anything could be a business as long as you're providing value to others. If your product is valuable, you know, it could save people time, it could save people money, it could let them do something they couldn't do otherwise. In the beginning, you asked me about, you know, the numbers and the revenue. I don't think a revenue is, to me, is not the real measure of the success of a business. It's a measure of sustainability. Like, I can keep doing this for long. But the real measure for me was, how much money did people make using my product? When someone like Sam Ovens contacted me and was like, I have a sustainable business, I have a very successful business because I was able to use my knowledge with your product and prototype something. Or a, you know, design agency contacts me and they're like, we want to thank you because we just landed a multi-million dollar contract with a client and we just spent like 3 hours doing the prototype. And oh, wow. That's the real measure of success. That's value.
You know what, Amir, I would like to measure my success that way. I don't know how to measure it that way, though, and it doesn't sound like we have an accurate way to do that. All we can get is, you and I both, is anecdotal evidence where maybe Sam says he used your software or someone else says that they heard one of my interviews and used it. It drives me nuts that I don't have as accurate a measurement of my effectiveness as I do of my profitability. I can go into Indinero.com right now and see where my revenue was for any point in the year. I don't have something similar that says how useful I was to the audience. How do we do that?
Well, your revenue is probably a byproduct of how much value you're providing to people.
It's also a big reflection of how much marketing I put in, you know, because if I just pump email ads out to my audience, a large number of them will leave, but a bigger percentage than today will buy for me. And then I'll think, great, I've done a better job this year than I did last year because more people buy. But that's not why.
That's why I mentioned value. Are you pumping these emails because you want to provide more value to your customers or extract value out of them? Right? Value addition is much, much better than value.
I'm saying that we need some measurement, some way to see how useful what we're building is for the audience. And it's not just because you and I might be hippies in San Francisco with this feeling that we don't care about money, we care about the world. It's because even if someone only cares about money, they want to know how effective they are for their customers, because that will then translate into more revenue in the future, more trust, more orders in the future. So it works for us, and it also works for someone who's only profit-minded. I wish we had that. I wish you can put your product out in the world and say, look, this week, my customers made $20,000 more than last week. It means that we're creating a better tool. By adding this button, we didn't just make more sales for ourselves, but we made more sales for our customers. And we can clearly, we don't have that. And I think when I talk about that, people start to think that I'm going off the deep end here.
No, you're right. You know, I don't think there is an accurate tool yet that lets people quantify their success using your product. But who knows? Maybe if there is such a tool, then you would focus only on making monetary impact, right? So that, you know, you measure the success of your business based on how much money it's making. But I don't think anyone should do this for the money. You want money, just go to, you know, go have a full-time job, do your best, maybe do some consulting on the side. You'll make money, but it's when you do something you're passionate about, it's kind of like the money comes as a byproduct. And I know this is, you know, sounds like a cliche, but again, it's true to my own experience. Do something like provide value to others, and just value comes back to you. It's, you know, it's karma. It's how, you know, things reciprocated with themselves. Now, you can launch a good product, but then, you know, for free. That means it's not really, you're not looking at it as a source of income. That's fine. I'd rather not give people like ads inside Keynote and charge them for the value, then, you know, put the product out for free, have it like as a, you know, very average quality and move on to something else. I wanted this product to be really, really high quality. And, you know, yeah, to some extent, I don't care that much about the money that comes from it. It allows me to do other things, but I'm not going to do it so that I can get more money.
All right. So you told me how you launched and you almost wanted to pull it down because you were worried about the quality of it. And then an order came in that made you think, all right, this is something. And you decided to reassured yourself by saying, I will have constant improvement. What I'm wondering is, how do you know what to improve? What do you do next?
You ask people. They will tell you what they want. I think.
How did you do that?
I just send them an email literally saying, what do you want me to create for you next?
What do you want me to build for you next?
Yeah, it's that simple.
So somebody bought from you for $9. You email them afterward and say, what should I do next?
Right. Because they have problems. They have challenges on a day-to-day. They know what they want. And it's probably my role as an entrepreneur to find out what these pains and problems are and find ways to solve them.
I've heard that if you ask people directly, what should I build next? They're going to ask you for a Frankenstein, a mishmash of all the things that they wish they had, but that they really couldn't need versus extracting what they need in other ways.
So remember, my audience is entrepreneurs, designers, developers, PM, people who already know what the problems are. Now, in retrospect, yeah, what I'm doing right now is I'm also asking them for their challenges. But what I'm finding is they also very good at brainstorming these solutions with me. So I'm not solving the problem alone.
How do you brainstorm it with them?
I don't know, you just start throwing ideas and they get very excited and they add their own ideas. And like, wow, we could also do this and it would be awesome if we also add this to it. And wow.
You mean you'll go back and forth like that with them via email or do you jump on the phone?
Oh, just the phone. Yeah, phone or Skype.
Can you give me an example of a feature that was developed with your customers?
Good question. The UX course that I have right now is a good example.
The what? The UX course?
Yeah, so I have a user experience course right now that's selling on Udemy. We have over 1,500 students on it. And I kept asking people, you know, what do you need? What is your, if I create a product for you, what would be next? And they're like, we want more tutorials. We want, you know, something that teaches us. We have an idea how to turn this into a prototype because your tool is great if you already know what you want, the prototype. But if I don't want what I, you know, if I don't know what I want, how do I get to that stage? Like, huh, there's a gap here. And I look at the books and the tools out there, and that wasn't anything specific for, you know, idea people like entrepreneurs and developers. If I have an idea, how do I turn it into a prototype? Most of the books and courses were to professional designers or UX practitioners. So I sit down 2 weeks, create the entire course. I know Gagan from Udemy. I know the guys there. They're like, yeah, put it on Udemy. It'll be awesome. And we put it in almost a year. Yeah, so it was about a year ago. And we have about 1,500 or 1,600 students right now. So that's an example. It's, you know, sometimes the solution doesn't have to be an app. That's something that I learned, you know, over and over. Your solution is whatever solves the problem. If it's a seminar, you know, you rent a conference room in San Francisco to deliver and fly over people, that's fine. If it's a mobile app, that's fine. If it's templates or a video tutorial or an ebook, as long as it solves the problem.
I see it right here. Designtrepreneur, that's what you call people who are designers and working for themselves.
Yeah.
$197 class on Udemy, design user experience in 7 simple steps. And that came from people saying, I bought this software, I don't have an idea, or I don't know how, or I have an idea, I don't know how to turn it into a product.
Right.
What else? How about a feature within the templates that came from audience feedback?
jQuery templates, for example, they email me and they say, you have web templates and you have mobile templates, but you don't have the jQuery mobile templates. I'm like, oh, yeah, you're right. We'll create them. And the one thing that people really loved in the product is if you buy it, he bought it like 2.5 years ago for the $9. you kept getting all these free updates up to the level of, you know, the $100 that someone is buying it at now. And if you buy it at the $100, you'll probably keep getting enough value that someone, you know, 5 years down the road will probably buy it for $500 and keep going, you know, up.
Because if you add another element to the bundle that I bought, I get it, even though I bought it in the past. So how did you decide to do that instead of saying, hey, there's an upgraded version? If you bought the $9 version and you loved it, wait till you see what I have for $97. You should pay for the latest version.
It took me a while to get to that mindset where I want to keep adding value to people without asking them for much value back. I thought the price was fair. They bought it. They supported me when I was launching the company. Let's speak to me. They were my investors, and I wouldn't, you know, ask them for money again and again. I would, you know, appreciate that they believed in the product early on. Same thing that people right now who believe in the product at this point will get enough value down the road from this product, from other one that we launched, that I, you know, I appreciate their support. That's how I give back. And people that I give this free updates to, these free updates, they love it. They tell their friends. They tweet about it. They even blog about it. And that word of mouth is more powerful than any, you know, advertising I can buy. Like I can take, you know, I don't know, charge them $10 more, but then go spend that money in advertising. I'd rather not charge them, and they will tell people about it because it's just good. And most of the traffic we're getting on KinoTalk is just word of mouth. I don't do much advertising or anything else. It's just people liking it, telling other people about it.
What about pricing? How did you know to go from $9 to $97?
Testing. So I kept, and that was over this time of 2 years. So every time I added enough templates and enough components to validate a new pricing point, I would test different pricing points to see what's fair for most people. And ironically, there was usually a pricing point where it's actually more than the previous price, but more people are buying because of the value price perception. Right? So not because you're going to price your product higher means less people would buy it. In fact, more people might buy it when you price it higher.
And when you do it, do you do A/B testing on the product price? You do.
A lot.
Now, when your customers come to you from word of mouth, that means I, as a customer, and I use Kinotopia. I did when I was prototyping. I still have it. But I use it. I love it. A friend of mine says that he wants to design an iOS app. I say, you've got to go and get Kinotopia. I send him over. Maybe I send a second friend over. I tell him the price is cheap. It's $97. And now one of them goes over to your site and sees that it's selling for, the product's selling for $125. And another comes back and says, hey, this thing is selling for $80. Doesn't that create, since they're friends of mine, doesn't that create an issue for you?
No, because I don't run the A/B test for too long. It's probably 3 to 5 days. There is enough traffic on the website to get enough data to make a decision.
Okay.
But in terms of pricing, I also sometimes follow my intuition. You know what? Like when I'm selling them like $27 after, you know, it was $9 and then it was $14, it was 27, so almost doubling plus or minus like 20% or something like that. And it was based on the value again. Do I think, like, for example, if this product saves a designer working in the US 1 hour, then it paid for itself, right? And that's the way I look at it. Right now, it's probably valued at less than 1/10 of the time it save them, and that's fine with me. They get the 9/10. That's the value they're getting. But I always had this concept of value in my mind is, if I think this is more valuable than the price I'm charging, I'll keep it at that price or increase it a little bit. But I'm always asking about the value something about the other, whether it's making more money or saving more money or saving time or being faster and so on.
I know that one of the issues you had in the past was you didn't want to charge more than $9 because you felt, hey, it's just a template. I should just charge $9. And what I'm understanding from this interview is the way you got past that is by saying, let's stop thinking about what it is specifically that I'm selling. Let's start thinking about how useful it is to the people who are buying it from me. how valuable is it to them? How much time is it saving them? How much money is it making them? And the more I start thinking about that, the less I get out of my own head about, is this something that people should be paying for at all? Should anyone pay $9 for templates?
Right. You should use your intuition, but at the same time, you shouldn't rely on when it comes to pricing, you shouldn't rely on subjective data. It's like thoughts in your mind or speculations. Just test it. It's not going to be a big deal. Maybe I pissed off a total of 50 people who came in the last 3 years, found at different prices, in different times. But I wasn't just increasing the prices. I was putting a lot more work into the product, creating more templates, upping the value, and then maybe asking for 1/10 of the value that I created.
The design, we talked earlier about how you will design, even though it's the same button that Apple gives all developers as part of their design set.
Their SDK,
right. It comes with a button. You want to reproduce that button in Kinotopia so that people can place it anywhere on the screen and see what it would look like if they designed it here or there. You recreate that button yourself? You sit down with what program and you start creating it?
It's all, so everything you see is designed from scratch inside Keynote.
The buttons that I have as templates are all designed within Keynote?
Yes. And Final.
I've got to go back in now and just take a look at that and see, because I never gave it much thought before.
All the way in, click on one of the components and change the colors. It's just live components, not screenshot. And like I said, it wouldn't have made much difference for like 90% of the people who buy it. But there's 10% who are meticulous designers who want to like recolor it or restyle it, and that I also care about.
All right. I think I've got an understanding of Kinotopia and how you built this business. Let's talk about two other things that I put off till later in the interview. The first is I want to talk about this, the way that you look at the world. You believe in energy manipulation, telekinesis, you told Jeremy, our producer. And then I also want to find out about books that you think are important. Because when Jeremy asked you, what question are we not thinking to ask you? You said, hey, there's some books that are worth recommending. So let's talk about this. You have a different way of looking at the world. I don't want to brush over it. I want to understand it because, and I want to come at it without any criticism or judgment. I need to understand you. How are you looking at the world differently from the rest of us?
So it's, by the way, it's not a belief. Like I respect people's beliefs, but I always rely on my own experience and what I formulate as my values and my way of moving forward.
Okay.
And I was lucky enough to have like extreme experiences that consolidated my beliefs in certain areas and changed my beliefs in other areas. Like that, that simple near-death experience. Are we, bodies carrying energies, or are we energies carrying bodies? It's a simple, it's like kind of switch in your mindset. But if you believe that your body carrying something mysterious, then this will remain a mystery to you until you die. But then you also believe that you're someone who can get hurt, who can kind of a lost leaf that's been disconnected from the branch and just withering the wind on its own. But I feel connected. I know we're connected beyond the bodies that we're inhabiting now, and connected to things, connected to other people. And whether we're connected through feelings of compassion or thoughts, or sometimes when you're physically connected with people and you feel good with someone, you feel bad with someone else. Why? Why do you feel like you're married, right? You love your wife. Can you tell me why you love her? It's probably not based on, you can't make a list and say, well, if you stop doing all these things, I'm not going to love her anymore. It's because you connected somehow. You're meant to be together. And I think compassion is very, very important for any entrepreneur.
Compassion.
Yeah.
Why is compassion important for entrepreneurs?
Because if you can't get yourself into the mind and life of a customer, it's very difficult for you if you're inhabiting this, Uber place where you're looking down at people, I'm going to create the solution for you, and you know, because I'm just that good. No, it's because you really took the time, had some empathy, compassion, and felt for that problem and felt how painful it was.
So based on the way that you understand the world, how are you getting into the mind and bodies of your customers differently from someone who says, I'm going to send out a survey, or I'm going to send out an email, or Amir says that he followed up with his customers after they bought and said, what else can I create for you, or what issues are you having? For someone who's just going to go through the tactics, how are they going to get a different result from you, who has this understanding of people's energy?
When I talk to a customer, I try not to talk to them from the mindset of someone trying to create a solution for them, but someone trying to really put myself in their shoes, literally just find out what it would feel to be that person.
What would it feel to be that whole person?
Yeah. But if I'm not, you know, if I'm no longer working, maybe that's something that I gain because I worked so many places and so many jobs and so many businesses that I put so many hats, and I can understand someone who's really still stuck in a job that they don't like, what it feels for them to be there. Or someone who wants to create a business but just stuck with an idea and it's draining their money, draining their bank account, and they don't seem to be going forward. I've lived through that. So maybe because I've lived through these experiences, I can connect with a lot of people who are trying to get out of something or get into something. But I don't try to think so much while I'm talking to someone. I try to just let it in and understand them as if, you know, I'm not talking to someone in a business setup, but I'm, you know, like talking to my girlfriend at the end of the day and, you know, hearing the problems, or like talking to a friend during the weekend and trying to help them with the challenge they're having.
Do you have an example of how this approach helped you create something, a Kinotopia? I want to get a concrete understanding of it.
Okay. So actually, it's something that I'm applying right now with the new, I wouldn't say it's a new product, but when Sam and I talked, and then Sam and I talked also with Dane Maxwell, and he gave me some advice about basically trying to understand more the challenges that people go through in my customer base. So I emailed people and literally just asked them, you know, a typical question that Sam Owens and Dane Maxwell ask, which is, you know, what's your day-to-day challenge? And I got a lot of responses.
You just emailed them and said, what's your day-to-day challenge?
Yes.
Okay.
And it was something that, you know, I was talking with Dane afterward, and he's like, you got a lot of work to do, because I received over 1,000 emails back from people, and I had to spend weeks and weeks sorting through them and be able to know how to, you know, start following up with people. But again, I was open to things. I'm not really trying to say, oh, most of them said there's this problem, then, you know, this must be a problem. There was something really beyond the problem, like a mindset or a fear or another, you know, desire that drove that problem. So what I'm following up with people now, and I'm asking them, how is, like, for example, a lot of people say focus is a problem. They can't focus on, they have an idea. Some of them have jobs, some of them, you know, don't. But they want to focus on the idea. And it's so difficult because it is email, it is social media, it is, you know, people interrupting them, it's news, Twitter, all these things that are just, you know, interruptions. But why are we allowing ourselves to be interrupted in the first place? What are we afraid of missing out? And when I talk to someone, I know that focus is a problem, but there is an underlying mindset that's causing that problem. And I want to understand that mindset, because I don't want to solve the surface problem. I want to solve the cause. Like, I don't want to work on the symptoms. Like, you have a headache, like you take a Tylenol, but really the headache is you haven't been drinking enough water. So I can ask you, when was the last time you had something sweet? When was the last time you drank? When do you have a headache? And so on. And then I can understand, oh, maybe try drinking some water. So it's similar to that.
I see. I feel like I want to understand this more than I can at the end of this interview. Do you feel like you have a good handle on this already?
I think so. I mean, I'm always available for people to ask questions. They can reach me out at, you know, my website, amirkeller.com, they can reach me through my email, and you know, you probably could give them the links to the email and website. And
do you want to give it to them here in this interview, or would you rather hold off on?
Sure. Yeah. So the website, my website / blog, is AmirKhella.com, and I've been like working slowly and starting like a newsletter where I gradually share my knowledge, my experience in a more actionable way than just, you know, giving the mindset and then random bits of inspirations and then some tools. So more of a framework for them to follow what I've done. And my email is simple. It's amir@khella.com. So AmirKhella.com. They can ask me anything.
And I guess I should have said this earlier, but Sam Ovens is someone who I interviewed here on Mixergy, who learned from Dane Maxwell how to talk to his customers, figure out what their what his customer's pain is, and then he developed a product for it. And he, before he hired developers to code up, I think he said he used Kinotopia. And he said, is this what you guys want me to develop? Should I hire someone to build this? And then he got some feedback and then changed.
He got some money.
And then he went and built it. So first he said, this is what I could build for you. And he used Kinotopia to express that. And then he said, if I build it, will you guys pay? I said, yes. So he said, all right, give me money now and I'll go build it for you. Do I have this right?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. And finally, books. What books do you recommend that we read?
On the top of my list is The Fountainhead.
It's what?
The Fountainhead by Ayn Rand.
The Fountainhead. I actually, you know what? It's so surprising that you said that, because I do feel that when you were working as a consultant for other companies, you were like Rourke, who was told to design something one way and you had a different outlet. Sorry?
Probably a little bit, yeah. I wasn't trying to make it so that I can impress them, but so I can do the right thing.
So why are you recommending The Fountainhead?
Because it's a good contrast for what people thought would be a selfish person for what really is a selfish person. So Ayn Rand talks a lot about selfishness. And selfishness people think about as, I'm going to do something that I care only about and I don't care about other people. And there is some truth to that. But selfishness means do the right thing, regardless of what people think, say, or do, because you know it's the right thing. So it contrasts two people, one who just went after the success and fame and money, regardless of what methods he used. And the other one just stuck with his values and what he thought was right. And I read the book like 3 times so far. It's a big book, it's like 1,000 pages.
What's the second? So it was The Fountainhead, and was there a second book that you said? No. Boy, the connection's a little bit rough today for some reason. I don't know why. Was there a second book that you said?
The second? No, I was saying it's 1,000 pages. I was saying the book is 1,000 pages, so make sure you dedicate a good chunk of time to it. Yeah. Another book, that's a good question, is... I have so many other second books. I think there is a book called, two books called Mastery. One recent one by, I think, Robert Greene, you interviewed him recently. Exergy. And there is another one, the name of the author escaped me. But I think there is a lot to be said about mastering something, because hacking is good and being able to get things done is good. But when you get to the depth of something, it's almost like you're finding a lot about yourself and what you do. It helps you understand who you are. And I think mastery is very important.
I think the other book is by George Leonard. I just looked it up.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. All right, and Bird by Bird, you also told Jeremy. What's Bird by Bird?
So Bird by Bird is subtitled as a book on writing, advice on writing and life, something like that. And the reason I like it is...
There it is. Bird by Bird, Some Instructions on Writing and Life.
Exactly. So first, I like people who take an example of something and they can generalize it to get life advice and make it like into a framework for understanding other stuff. So she used writing as a framework for understanding life. And one of the things she said that really stuck with me, especially I was reading recently the biography of Gandhi, and they both talk about the service, about that's the highest value and the highest thing you can ever do in life, is be of service to others. And she said that once you find your path to freedom, your role is to go back and lead others along this path, because so many are looking for it. And that's what I decided to do in my life next, is to help as much people, because I've achieved to a large extent my own financial freedom, and I'm in control of my own, you know, destiny, not entirely, but to the extent that I can control it. But I control my day, I control my vacations, and I control my income. And a lot of people right now are just stuck somewhere where they know they have this yearning for doing something that is valuable to others and they're passionate about, but they don't know the path. And I think leading people along that path is what this book kind of enlightened me to see.
Right. I just, as we were talking, I sent the sample chapter to my Kindle of Bird by Bird and the other books I've read. All right. The website is kinotopia.com. And Amir, thank you for sharing the story of how you built up this business.
My pleasure.
Thank you all for watching. Bye, guys.